From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Some tough words from the White House today on immigration. In the Oval Office, President Trump said he's been in conversation with Defense Secretary James Mattis about militarizing the border with Mexico.
We are going to be doing some things. I've been speaking with General Mattis. We're going to be doing things militarily. Until we can have a wall and proper security, we're going to be guarding our border with the military. That's a big step. We really haven't done that before, or certainly not very much before.
And on Twitter this morning, Trump for the first time threatened to withdraw U.S. aid to Honduras as a caravan of more than 1,000 mostly Honduran immigrants travels across Mexico, some with hopes of winning asylum in the U.S. And the rhetoric comes as Trump prepares his new legislation that includes toughening asylum requirements and allowing undocumented immigrant families to be detained for longer periods of time. Scott Horsley, NPR White House correspondent, is here. And start with the politics, Scott. The New York Times spoke with the organizers of the caravan. These are people fleeing violence in Central America. And they say few in the group are going to be seeking asylum in the U.S. There's speculation that these increasing threats are in response to the increasing criticism the president is getting from conservatives like Ann Coulter and Laura Ingraham for failing to get that wall built.
It's not entirely clear what is motivating the president, but certainly what is not motivating the president to take this hard line is some kind of surge in the number of illegal border crossings. There has just not been a surge in illegal border crossings, either in total or if you want to talk about unaccompanied minors or family units. I've been reviewing the data this morning. If you talk about unaccompanied minors, it's down 36% from a year ago in the first 5 months of the year. Family units down 46%. Overall apprehensions at the border are down from previous years, although not as far down as they were in the early months of the Trump administration. But whatever the president is responding to, either pressure from the far right or pressure from people in his base or something he saw on Fox News, he's not responding to actual number of border crossings.
Well, one of his criticisms has been what he calls a catch and release policy when it comes to immigrants detained on the border. So do we know what's, he's proposing in legislation?
Yeah, proposing in legislation is probably too strong. What we had yesterday was kind of we had a background briefing from some senior administration officials who seemed to have been trotted out for reporters to try to make sense of the president's tweets. And they did complain about a number of policies, many of which date back to the George W. Bush administration, policies and laws and judicial decisions, which do in some cases require that folks who've been captured crossing the border be released after a short period of time. In the case of minors who are not from Canada or Mexico, they're often turned over to relatives here in this country. In the case of family units, there's a judicial decision that says they can't be held for more than 20 days. So we've heard complaints about that from the White House and sort of a general sense that, gosh, Congress ought to do something about this, but no real legislative proposal or remedy other than, the president doesn't like this and he'd like it to be different.
Is there a sense that we might have U.S. military on the border?
That was a bolt from the blue. The president was having a photo op this morning with leaders of the Baltic countries, and he just blurted out that he's been talking with General Mattis, the defense secretary, about bringing in, I'm not sure if he means National Guard troops or active duty service members. Who knows? That there's been nothing said about that until just now. After we heard those remarks within the last hour, we've been pressing the White House, what the heck does this mean? I haven't gotten an answer yet, but we'll keep you posted on that. Again, it would be an extraordinary step. There have been times when National Guard troops have been mobilized to deal with border crossings, but it would be a remarkable step at a time when we see the overall traffic at the border down.
Yeah, George W. Bush did it. But I want to ask you, make sure we've asked you about the president speaking with EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt last night and Chief of Staff John Kelly phoning him this morning, apparently to buck him up because there's a lot of scrutiny. He had expensive travel. Pruitt, he's taken at taxpayer expense. He got a low rent on a D.C. condo linked to a lobbying firm with business with the EPA.
The thing with Scott Pruitt is, and of course the most recent story was an Atlantic article that after having a request to give salary increases to two political aides at the EPA, having that request turned down by the White House, Pruitt then apparently used money from the Safe Drinking Water Act to pad these folks' salaries in defiance of the White House directive. But the thing with Scott Pruitt is the White House really likes what he's doing in terms of rolling back Obama-era rules. They just don't like some of the extracurricular stuff that's going on. We did hear the president try to buck him up last night. We also heard Trump responding to a reporter's question this morning saying, I hope he's going to be great, saying that about his EPA administrator. But, you know, those sorts of shows of support from the president and from the White House often have a pretty short half-life.
Scott Horsley, NPR White House correspondent, thank you.
You're welcome.
And a major milestone today in Robert Mueller's Russia investigation. A judge sentenced Alex van der Zwaan to 30 days in prison for lying to federal investigators. Van der Zwaan is an associate of Rick Gates, who is a former deputy Trump campaign manager. He is also the first to be sentenced out of the 22 people the special counsel has brought charges against so far. NPR national security editor Phil Ewing is here with the latest. Phil, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure. So this lawyer sentenced today, Alex van der Zwaan. He was also fined $20,000. But, you know, remind us who he is and what his connections are to the people that Mueller's investigating.
He is a Dutch national who works in London as an attorney. And in his previous life, he worked for an international law firm there called Skadden Arps, which was retained in 2012 by Paul Manafort and Rick Gates and people they were doing business with on behalf of the then government of Ukraine. And the regime at that time was prosecuting an opposition political figure named Yulia Tymoshenko. And it was being criticized because people on the outside said the Tymoshenko charges were trumped up and she was being silenced and bullied wrongly. She's since been cleared of any charges from that era. But Skadden Arps and Alex van der Zwaan, who you mentioned, were part of the legal team brought in to help bolster the case, again, as part of this work that Manafort and Gates were doing on behalf of the Ukrainian regime. They've been charged by the special counsel's office with allegedly laundering money and working as unregistered foreign agents and a whole host of other crimes. Gates has pleaded guilty. Manafort says he's innocent of these charges and he's asked for them to be dismissed.
As part of this plea deal, van der Zwaan has agreed to waive his rights to get information about this investigation, which is a very compelling little tidbit. Why did Mueller insist on keeping those records secret?
The special counsel's office likes to do its talking via its work, and that's the only way that we get little insights into what it has or what it knows or what it wants to accomplish. And so by agreeing to this proviso, what has happened here is the normal course of discovery or the normal rights that a defendant would have in this case to ask for information the government has are not going to be executed as part of this strategy to keep whatever evidence or whatever intentions the special counsel has secret. And so far, they've been very successful at doing that because very few things tend to leak out of the special counsel's office and get into the press.
Right, which of course means the public isn't going to get this information as well, which is the bigger point there. But we're also learning more about the scope of the investigation from a memo that Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein wrote back in August. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that's correct. It's a fascinating document. I have it here. This appeared as a part of some court filings, and it's a follow-up to the initial memorandum issued by Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, appointing Mueller and giving him kind of the scope of work that he would expect from the special counsel's office. It mentions the memo that appointed him, and it says this: the following allegations were within the scope of the investigation at the time of your appointment and are within the scope of this order, colon, and then there's a big black square on the page. Hmm. And it goes on to detail allegations against Paul Manafort, whom we mentioned a minute ago, Donald Trump's former campaign chairman. And what it says is that he may, according to allegations, have committed a crime or crimes by colluding with Russian government officials as a part of their active measures waged against the United States in 2016. And then from there, there's another long black square of redactions. And so we don't know exactly the type of instructions that the Deputy Attorney General gave to the special counsel, except to say that there's a lot more here that Mueller's office could be charged with investigating or persons it could be looking into. We just don't know right now what they are.
Now, I also understand that that memo does bring up Paul Manafort's connections to Ukraine, which is important as well, because his lawyers are trying to say that the charges related to his dealings in Ukraine have exceeded Mueller's mandate and therefore should be thrown out.
That's right. Not according to this material. According to the documents produced by the special counsel's office, he was specifically empowered by Mr. Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general, to see whether or not Manafort may have committed a crime or crimes, I'm quoting here, arising out of payments he received from the Ukrainian government before and during the tenure of President Viktor Yanukovych. In other words, Rosenstein made it part of Mueller's mandate at the time of his appointment to look into these matters, not just involving collusion, but other crimes, as we know, that may or may not have taken place that the special counsel could discover as part of his investigation.
Okay, Phil, so as all of this is swirling around, we also have heard recently that President Trump has proposed a meeting with Vladimir Putin at the White House. I just want to get your thoughts on that too.
Yeah, it's a very interesting detail. The White House said yesterday that the negotiations between the two leaders are at a very early stage. Trump had a phone call with Putin recently after his re-election there, and he was criticized by Democrats and outsiders for not taking a stronger line, for congratulating him on what critics called a sham election, for not raising the poisoning by Russia of a British agent who was a Russian intelligence officer and his daughter in the UK. And the interesting thing about that is, with all this swirling, it remains to be seen how well these leaders can actually come together if they ever do.
NPR's Phil Ewing, thanks.
Thank you.
We've been looking at how the gun lobby has pushed to restrict information about firearms, something that came up a lot during the March for Our Lives rally in Washington last month. Here's Parkland student Jacqueline Corin.
This issue is undoubtedly an epidemic that affects communities of all classes, an epidemic that the Center for Disease Control does not have the funds to research.
Yesterday, we looked at the 1996 Dickey Amendment that cut CDC funding for gun violence research. Today, the TIAA Amendment that backers say protects innocent gun shops, but detractors like former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg say keeps researchers and the public from knowing where guns used in crimes come from. Daniel Webster is familiar with it. He's a professor of health policy and management at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. And professor, we want to start there. Bloomberg Philanthropies gave funding to the school, right?
Well, Michael Bloomberg has made a big commitment to public health globally and domestically. And so he's given funds to our school, and we're very grateful for that. The center I direct, the Center for Gun Policy and Research, has received some modest contributions from Bloomberg Philanthropies, but that has not constituted the majority of our funding. Most of our funding is from other foundations.
Well, as you know, that though, is going to immediately taint you in the eyes of gun rights advocates who feel that Mayor Bloomberg is unfairly attacking this amendment. But we will get to that. We'll bring that up again. But before, tell us why you started the research that you did in the 90s, what you found.
Sure. I was very intrigued by some research that was being done, being led by Glenn Pierce, who is at Northeastern University. He demonstrated that a very small proportion of licensed gun dealers, as little as 1%, sold roughly 60% of the guns used in crime. And we know that certain gun dealers sell more guns than others, but it was a very skewed distribution.
Well, let me jump in to say, first of all, that this information about, wow, it's just a few of the stores that sell most of the guns used in crime. It was the 2003 TIAA Amendment, which stopped the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives from sharing that information. What was your thinking when that happened?
Oh, I was very disturbed because I knew from not only the research that I was doing using the same type of data. These are data just so folks understand what the data are. Mm-hmm. When local police recover a firearm from a criminal suspect or a crime scene, they can share the basic information about the firearm, and ATF will gather the information to trace where that gun initially was sold and when and to whom. So I had done some research looking particularly at the role of a small number of gun dealers and selling guns later used in crime, and then some things that were done to draw attention to those gun dealers, sometimes simply with bad publicity and sometimes with lawsuits or criminal prosecutions brought against them. And when there was some accountability process, you had a notable reduction in the flow of guns coming from those type of gun dealers into the hands of criminals. And just as we were making those discoveries and publishing those data, we found that this Tiahrt Amendment was passed and restricted our ability to obtain that data. So since that time, we've only been able to get a little bit of data here and there from local law enforcement agencies rather than get what we had gotten from the ATF, which is a national database.
Well, look, the Boston Globe has done some terrific reporting on this, and they point out that you can find out the states that some, you know, guns come from. In Massachusetts, it's New Hampshire, Maine, and Florida. But private researchers like yourself, universities, and the public don't have, you know, the data that could show the county or the store. But why would the average citizen need to know that?
Well, I think many gun owners want to know whether to do business with a gun shop or not. But I also think it's a matter of public safety that there should be local pressure when there's a local business that appears to, you know, engage in practices that have an important bearing on public safety. And I've seen this in many different cities. Baltimore, I have the most direct access to. And we once had a gun shop just over the city line that accounted for a very large share of the guns used in crime year in and year out, till eventually the compliance with gun laws were so poor that the ATF finally, after literally a decade, was able to take his license away. We're literally a half a mile away from him. Another gun shop virtually never had a gun show up in crime. So, and, you know, this is a city and a region with a high rate of gun violence. And it seems to me that both citizens and public officials should want to know if there are businesses that are contributing to an important public safety problem.
Sounds like you're saying that, you know, this is something that gun shops should welcome, because, you know, if they could ferret out the one with the bad practices among them, it would be better for their reputations overall.
Yes, absolutely, because their records generally are quite good and they can distinguish themselves as a safe and responsible gun shop. The only thing that the Tiahrt Amendment did was protect the bad gun dealers. It did nothing to help the good gun dealers, because they didn't need help. The data suggests that, again, most comply with laws and are quite responsible.
Well, as you know, it was Todd Tiahrt, the Republican from Kansas, who initially sponsored this restriction in 2003. He left Congress in 2011. He runs a consulting firm. And at the time, he said the main point of his legislation was to prevent the public release of data on gun owners to protect their privacy, the privacy of American citizens. He also told the Washington Post, "I wanted to make sure I was fulfilling the needs of my friends who are firearms dealers." And the NRA and other supporters of the amendment go a little further. They say that a lot of traced guns are not used in crimes. So, for instance, if somebody has a gun taken away, they give the example of, let's say you bring your gun into an election area where you're not allowed to have them. It might be taken away and traced, but it wasn't really used in a crime, and it might poorly reflect on a gun store when it shouldn't. The NRA also points out that the Fraternal Order of Police is very much against overturning this amendment and public awareness of the tracing of guns, because it can interfere with the work that they do. And they point to former Mayor Bloomberg, who allowed New York City police to get trace data from the ATF, not for a criminal investigation, but for a civil lawsuit. And they claim investigators for that civil lawsuit interfered with sting operations that the ATF was holding. So they say it's got to stay with the ATF, because you'll jeopardize informants and police work. And that's primarily why the information has to stay with the ATF. Your thoughts?
Well, I have no knowledge about whether undercover operations from private investigators hired by Mayor Bloomberg interfered with anything the ATF was doing. I certainly haven't seen that. I want to go to the first issue, that the Tiahrt Amendment protects gun owners. I've never in my entire 25-year career heard of any research with crime gun trace data where the name of an individual gun purchaser or possessor was ever released as part of a research study. So that's simply a red herring and not true. This was done principally, as Representative Tiahrt said, to protect people who sell firearms. And if you look at the record of Congress in recent years, in recent decades, what you'll find is a very consistent pattern where they are quick to pass laws that protect people who sell guns, but are very reticent to pass laws that protect the public from problematic gun dealers. That was the case with the Tiahrt Amendment, and it was the case subsequently to the federal law that basically prevents lawsuits against anyone who makes or sells guns. So Mr. Tiahrt was, what was behind and the whole intent of the amendment was to protect people who sold firearms. That's it.
Well, and as we said, he's quoted as saying that.
And I'd also just very briefly, as it relates to New York City doing the undercover stings, what they found is, using the trace data, they found the problematic gun dealers, and they did undercover stings and tried to stage blatantly illegal transactions. And a very large share of those individuals are very willing to engage in those illegal transactions. So what was done in that case also really has no relevance to research. Researchers don't launch undercover stings. We simply try to understand what's going on with the data and report that. And I think, again, it's greatly in the public's interest for research to be able to have that information so you can fully understand how guns make their ways to criminals and which policies are most effective in preventing that.
That's Daniel Webster, professor of health policy and management at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Professor Webster, Daniel, thank you so much for talking to us about it.
Thank you.
Electric car maker Tesla had a big open on Wall Street this morning. Shares jumped almost 7%, even as the company reported major production delays of its Model 3. Tesla said today that it will miss its production goal of 2,500 Model 3 cars a week in the first quarter of the year. And that is just one of the many, many headwinds facing Tesla CEO Elon Musk. Joining us now is Michael Regan. He's senior editor at Bloomberg News. Mike, it's good to have you back.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So let's start with some of this production news that we're getting today. We're even hearing reports that Elon Musk is back to sleeping on the factory floor to keep tabs on the Model 3. What's the problem?
Yeah, right. So he tweeted that he was back to sleeping on the factory floor. He didn't mention how well he was actually sleeping, though. And the latest batch of problems all started more than a week ago as Wall Street analysts began expressing a lot of skepticism about these production targets. They were supposed to reach 2,500 cars a week by the end of March for the Model 3. Now, this is the lower-priced Tesla, and it was hoped to be a hot mess market seller that would really help the company get closer to profitability. So today they did alleviate some of those concerns by announcing they had produced about 2,020 Model 3s in the last 7 days, and that's really a doubling of the production from earlier in the quarter. And they said they were able to do that by addressing some supply chain bottlenecks and some production problems, including they had to shut the factory a few times to upgrade equipment. So that did help the stock recover a little bit, but it's really sort of been falling aggressively over the last month or so.
Yeah, I mean, so maybe they improved a little bit, but it may not be enough to assuage critics who say the company is burning through money. Investors are very worried about the company's debt load. We just learned recently that Tesla says the autopilot was engaged when a Tesla car crashed into a highway barrier in California last month. The driver died. So they've got all these things going on now. But what about that crash? What more do we know about it and how Tesla's going to handle that?
Right. And all this news sort of broke at the same time, the issues with the production targets and this crash. So the crash was a Model X, which is the higher end model, more expensive. And basically the driver had put it on autopilot and took his hands off the wheel for a few seconds before the car crashed into a highway divider and burst into flames, basically. And it's a pretty big hit for the company, considering they were considered to be sort of out in front as one of the pioneering companies in self-driving cars. And it's really a big hit for the entire notion of self-driving cars. Remember, it occurred just days after a self-driving Uber car struck and killed a pedestrian in Arizona.
Right.
It's the third fatal crash of a Tesla while on autopilot. Now, Tesla still contends that these vehicles with autopilot systems are almost four times less likely to be involved in fatal accidents. But still, these fatal crashes create a lot of headlines and they stoke a lot of concerns about the technology and whether it's ready for prime time yet.
Tesla shares down almost 18% since the beginning of the year. Big hit. What's Tesla's way out of this?
Well, I guess they really just have to ramp up the production as much as they can. I mean, you know, that's the issue. It's they have to sort of ratchet up the volume and deliver as many cars as they possibly can. It's a company that has survived basically by issuing new stock and new bonds. And both of those are looking harder to do now.
Yeah. Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Civil rights tourism is taking off. This year, the National Park Service launched a new U.S. Civil Rights Trail. It connects more than 100 churches, schools, and courthouses in 14 states from Louisiana to Delaware. And Congress designated the site around Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s former church in Atlanta a National Historic Park. But in cities across the country, there are civil rights landmarks that have yet to be recognized, and some are in bad shape, even in King's hometown of Atlanta. Stephanie Stokes from member station WABE reports.
The old Pascal's restaurant isn't how Candy Tate remembers it from her childhood.
It's in pretty dilapidated condition. Pieces falling off. There's now a fence around the property.
The storefront stands along Martin Luther King Jr. Drive on Atlanta's west side. It's empty and boarded up with graffiti covering the plywood. When Tate's grandpa, Theodore Johnson, used to bring her here decades ago, the restaurant was bustling.
And when he would walk in, they would say, "Hi, Mr. Johnson," and, you know, "What are you having?" And you'd see all of the local politicians, you know, meeting and greeting. It was City Hall for the community.
That was especially true during the Civil Rights era. Leaders like Martin Luther King Jr. came to Pascal's to strategize. So did students from the cluster of black colleges and universities just south of here.
Students would meet their parents after they had been arrested during the student movement and be fed a meal. So the owners of the restaurant were very much into the civil rights movement.
Tate's afraid history like that could be lost if this property continues to decay. And it isn't Atlanta's only civil rights site in disrepair.
There's a lot here that could be restored and brought back to life.
Glenn Eskew is a history professor at Georgia State University. He says just across from Pascal's is the old West Hunter Street Baptist Church. Its stained glass windows are obscured by wood. The Reverend Ralph David Abernathy was once a pastor there.
Abernathy, of course, was Dr. King's right hand. They played off each other, and they did so to the success of the movement.
Eskew says Atlanta actually was the first to preserve civil rights history when it built a memorial for Dr. King. But the city still hasn't captured the whole narrative.
Dr. King was just part of the story of the civil rights movement, and Dr. King didn't do it alone. You know, there were thousands and thousands of people who were involved in the struggle.
Preserving buildings, though, takes more than history. It also takes money, political will, and time. But with some of the civil rights sites around Atlanta, there might not be much time left. Atlanta architect Jack Pyburn has surveyed the old Pascal's restaurant, and he says it's at a critical point.
If there's an urgency, it is the fact that these properties, you know, were not built with big budgets. They were generally, because of the circumstances, they were modest structures. And so they need attention.
It's possible that attention might still come. Atlanta City Council member Ivory Young represents the West Side neighborhoods where many of these landmarks are. And he says the city's talking about creating a new historic district around them.
So there's a lot of energy and excitement. And we're going to do everything we can to make this a priority.
The federal government also just announced a new grant for the West Hunter Street Baptist Church. So that's $500,000 toward its preservation. Outside the old Pascal's, Candy Tate says she hopes to see this site restored too.
What happened here at Pascal's, right here where we're standing, is the story of the nation.
Because civil rights history, she says, is American history. For Here and Now, I'm Stephanie Stokes in Atlanta.
From Atlanta, where King was born, to Memphis, Tennessee, where he was assassinated on April 4th, 1968. Here Now's Alex Ashlock visited the Lorraine Motel where he was killed, and we are rebroadcasting Alex's report from 2016 today.
On April 4th, 1968, CBS anchor Walter Cronkite had just about finished up his evening news broadcast when this news broke.
Good evening. Dr. Martin Luther King, the apostle of nonviolence in the civil rights movement, has been shot to death in Memphis, Tennessee.
King was standing on the hotel's second floor balcony with several friends. They were getting ready to go out for dinner when a bullet fired from a boarding house across the street struck him in the face. There's a famous picture, the others on the balcony, pointing to where they thought the bullet had come from. Dr. King had come to Memphis to support black sanitation workers. They had been on strike since mid-February that year. Faith Morris remembers. She was born in Memphis. Today she works at the National Civil Rights Museum at the Lorraine Motel.
The sanitation workers were trying to organize, trying to unionize. They were fighting against pretty abysmal conditions, life-threatening conditions, poor wages, you know, just all down the line. No equality whatsoever among the races.
That included the fact that the black garbage men weren't even allowed to ride in the cab of the garbage trucks. That was reserved for white workers only. In fact, before the strike started, two black workers were killed when they sought shelter in the back of their truck with the garbage, and the compressor was accidentally triggered. Stories that reflect the struggle fill the exhibit halls at the National Civil Rights Museum. It starts with slavery, moves through the Civil War and Reconstruction, Jim Crow and the seminal events of the movement, Rosa Parks and the Montgomery bus boycott, the Freedom Rides, Selma and Bloody Sunday, the Poor People's Campaign. The tour ends at the balcony, King's room preserved behind a clear plastic barrier, just as it was when he shut the door that April evening. Bed sheets must, unfinished cups of coffee. Faith Morris was in grade school when the civil rights leader was murdered.
As a little girl, I saw what it did to our city. Most of us were just trying to understand why something so horrific had happened to a man who was here to do a really good thing.
On the day I visited the Lorraine Motel and the museum, there were children and school groups strolling through the exhibits. And I also met another visitor, Jack Washington, an African-American from Chicago.
It was quite eye-opening for me. It was quite a realization of seeing and knowing the things that we basically have taken for granted. And actually, if he wasn't part of the struggle back in the day, which I am older than, I'm 65 years old, so this was part of my era. And it just kind of brought to life some of the things that I wasn't aware of and can appreciate where I am today.
Do you remember the assassination?
That I do very well.
What did it mean to see the space where it actually happened?
It was just kind of emotional. It was just kind of touching that to see where everything culminated in this particular spot.
The night before King was killed, he spoke at a church in Memphis. What he said that night stands in stark reflection today. but it was something he often spoke publicly about, his own mortality.
Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
According to biographer Taylor Branch, right before he was shot, King spoke to a musician who was going to perform at a service they would both attend that evening. "Make sure you play Take My Hand, Precious Lord in the meeting tonight," King said. That was his favorite hymn. He had often invited gospel singer Mahalia Jackson to sing it at civil rights rallies to inspire crowds. She sang it for him one more time at his funeral to try to soothe the mourners.
Precious Lord, take my hand, lead me on.
For Here and Now, I'm Alex Ashlock.
Let me stand
This song is going to bring back a flood of memories for many. Mike Post always wrote the themes for Stephen Bochco's mega hits like Hill Street Blues or L.A. Law. Greg Hoblit always directed Bochco's shows, giving them their grit or their sophisticated sheen. The people who worked on his shows, which included Doogie Howser, M.D. and NYPD Blue, became family. As you've probably heard, writer-producer Stephen Bochco died Sunday after a four-year-long battle with leukemia. Today we wanted to bring in two of the actors in his orbit. Jill Eikenberry and Michael Tucker, who are married, played the married couple Ann Kelsey and Stuart Markowitz on L.A. Law. In this scene from 1986, Ann and Stuart are at a stuffy dinner party, Ann describing how unhappy she is.
Are you happy, Stuart?
I'm not unhappy.
That's not good enough.
Look at me. I am what I am. I'm short. No, believe me, I'm short. You can't tell from where you stand. I'm short. And I don't do Nautilus or anything. I'm not sexy. And I bruise easily.
Wait a minute, I thought this show was supposed to be about the law. Jill Eikenberry and Michael Tucker happen to be in Italy, so we are speaking to them on a cell phone. Jill, start with you. I'm just so sorry.
Yeah, this is a big one. This is really a big one for so many people.
Tell us why. Why did Steve Bochco loom so large?
My husband, he went to school with him, and Stephen wrote the parts for us in L.A. Law, which never happens that a couple gets parts written for them. His kind of television and his approach to that thing you were talking about, you know, you don't usually know the lives of the people that you're watching on the cop show or the law show. You don't really know what they do, as Stephen said, the other 23 hours of the day. And he was very intent on letting the audience in on who those people were. And now a lot of people are doing that. But before that, nobody was.
No. And he once told me he was the son of a classical violinist. He didn't hang out with cops to learn how cops talk. He didn't roam a law firm to pick up on the patter. It was just his sense of the humanity
Yeah, and another thing that people always commented on was that the workplace was really what it was about. It wasn't just about the case or the perp that they were chasing. It was all the different levels, from the guy that delivers the mail, you know, to the head of the firm. It was, everybody was very much a part of the ensemble.
I'd love it if you could pass the phone to that
shorter
guy. I'm
passing the phone to my husband. Here he is.
Husband here.
Michael. Listen, I am so sorry. You've known Steve for so long. But talk about what he was like as a producer, you know, fighting Hollywood to do things his way.
Yeah, he really enjoyed going against the system, I think is the best way to put it. And he angered a lot of people. But there was never a network person on the set of L.A. Law the entire 8 years. He forbade it. He said, you do your job and you let me do my job. And I think it's one of the reasons his shows were so good.
He had misses, although I still will say that ABC's Cop Rock, which was a police drama combined with Broadway-style singing, was ahead of its time and marvelous. But he was, of course, known for the shows and the careers that he launched. The names, Neil Patrick Harris, Blair Underwood, Bryan Cranston, Harry Hamlin, Corbin Burnson, Jimmy Smits. Let's just listen to a clip of Jimmy Smits playing Victor Cifuentes in one of his courtroom monologues.
That man raped that woman. Now, he put her at risk for a life-threatening disease. He puts her partners at risk. He should be tested for AIDS the way you test a dog for rabies.
Victor, Your Honor.
He should be tied down and blood should be drawn from him.
Mr. Cifuentes.
That's a great scene. Though.
Yeah. Just your thoughts on, I mean, I know you and Jill are heading back to Los Angeles. A very sad moment, but what a gathering of the people that Steve Bochco launched.
I think it's going to be quite a gathering. It's going to be an enormous outpouring. We'll all gather and we'll tell stories, I would imagine. That's what we did when Stephen was alive, and I imagine that's what we'll do now.
Yeah. And just again, as an actor who, you know, got to speak his words.
Well, he made me really smart. That hasn't been. His words were fantastic. And he did an interesting thing. He wrote the roles for us. The part that he wrote for Jill was this very dynamic, aggressive woman. And Jill is not, by nature, an aggressive woman. He wrote the part for me of a very shy, retiring, sort of bumbling guy, and that's not pretty much my personality. But that was a very smart thing to do, let actors act. And I think it's one of the reasons his shows were so good.
Michael Tucker, Jill Eikenberry, again, so sorry for your loss. Anne Kelsey and Stuart Markowitz on L.A. Law. I think a lot of people are going to be downloading L.A. Law, NYPD Blue, Hill Street Blues, Doogie Howser, M.D.
That'll be a great thing.
Thank you, and again, sorry for your loss.
Thank you. Thank you, Robin.
And we're going to leave you with Stephen Bochco's best-known writing, The Caution at the End of Every Roll Call in Hill Street Blues.
Hey, let's be careful out here.
Let's be careful out there. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.